from deep inside your radio.
From London, England, ladies and gentlemen, where we are now glimpsing perhaps a little bit more about a story I shared with you last week. The story that former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, I guess in a race with former U.S. President Bill Clinton to see who can get richer faster off their contacts in high office, had a deal, apparently, some kind of contractual consulting relationship, you know, pro bono, of course, with the fine nation of Kazakhstan. No joke, not a Sacha Baron Cohen joke. Or is it? Today's Sunday Telegraph in London sheds what could be new light or maybe just some welcome heat on the subject. President Nazarbayev's decision to engage Blair as an official advisor was motivated, says the paper, paper's investigations editor, if you please, by President Nazarbayev's lifelong ambition to win the Nobel Peace Prize. I know it sounds absurd, but then Henry Kissinger, Lê Đức Thọ, President Drone. The Kazakh regime has been heavily criticized for its human rights record, but it's also retained the services of the former communications chief of the Blair administration, Alistair Campbell, and Jonathan Powell, Blair's former chief of staff. So they basically reassembled the Blair government in pursuit of the president's dream of the Nobel Peace Prize, according to the Telegraph. Blair says he's not profiting from his links with Kazakhstan. Highly placed sources connected to Nazarbayev said the president hopes his association with Blair would enable him to secure a nomination for the Peace Prize next year to mark his 20 years in power. That's peaceful. He's relying on Blair and key advisors to help him show how he is reforming his country and also to emphasize the key strategic and intelligence role this country played during the Iraq War and the war in Afghanistan. Peace Prize, you see. He hopes they will help him highlight his role encouraging the United Nations General Assembly to adopt August 29th as the International Day Against Nuclear Tests and his initiative to hold two international forums of world and traditional religions in his capital to foster cooperation between faiths, or among faiths, one might say. Others accuse him of human rights abuses. The country sits at number 105 on Transparency International's Table of Corruption, at 162 on the Press Freedom Index published by Reporters Without Borders. Criticizing the president in person is illegal under the Kazakhstan Criminal Code. International monitors say the police routinely torture suspects. One human rights campaigner was jailed for 4 years after a traffic accident that was apparently not his fault. Another critic was discovered dead with a gun by his side. An official inquiry said he killed himself. He apparently shot himself twice in the chest before putting a third bullet in his head. The Nobel Peace Prize, ladies and gentlemen. Maybe Tony Blair can get it for me. I'm going to check. Hello, welcome to the show.
What is the wrong conclusion? Why do we hesitate? What is going on now? Stop and re-estimate. What is the wrong conclusion? Why do we hesitate? What is going on now? Stop and re-estimate. What is the wrong conclusion?
Whatever came of the blame we had to follow.
Why do we hesitate?
Hey,
what is going on? Stop.
Surely
and
we give up our dream again.
What is the wrong conclusion?
When the rumors over with, being so
what is going on? Stop and we hesitate.
Time will take its time.
Conclusion.
Winding away will make it shine. Now it is.
from London, England, where, congratulations, Catholics, now you can marry into the royal family. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of... You cannot be heir to the throne, because that would mean a Catholic would be head of the Church of England, and Henry VIII would be turning over on in his rotisserie. But you can marry... Anyway, welcome to this edition of the show. Hey, what's happening at Nice Corp? Nice people doing nice things. The police investigation into phone hacking by the News of the World has now spread to the publishing world. Oh, that's so civilized normally, isn't it? A high-profile agent and a celebrity book publisher apparently were targeted. Peter Cox, who worked with the late Linda McCartney, and John Blake, who's worked with a couple of British celebrities not known to Americans, have each been told by the police they appear to have been targeted by illegal surveillance by the now-shuttered tabloid newspaper owned by Nice Corp, i.e. Rupert Murdoch. Cox told the Guardian newspaper he was stunned to learn from the Metropolitan Police that someone had been eavesdropping on him. It's a little like coming home to find your place has been burgled or burglarized. Even worse. Angered by what he describes as a violation, he added, "I'm quite interested in suing the hell out of them." Sir, they have no money. Really. They need a whole new business model to have some money. Police have now shown Cox handwritten notes reproduced from his own calls. His lawyers have advised him against revealing details, he said. So we'll have to hack his lawyer's phone now to find out what's going on. Blake, a publisher of celebrity books and a former journalist on the tabloid newspaper The Sun, appeared more sanguine. He was surprised, but not shocked, to be contacted by the police. Quote, "I was vaguely flattered in a pathetic way," unquote. He should be writing. Screw pub, you know, babe, with a way with words like that. Now, speaking of words, ladies and gentlemen, what do we tell the children? We tell the children don't lie, don't we? The Justice Department, according to Wired, is proposing new Freedom of Information Act rules allowing the government to inform the public that government records don't exist, even if they do. Send the kids to another room, won't you? The proposal will codify existing practice. The government has already lied to requesters of public records that relevant documents did not exist. The government may assert that it can neither confirm nor deny that relevant records exist if the matter involves national security. Under the latest proposal, federal Freedom of Information Act requesters might not sue to challenge the designation because the government has told them they did not exist, you see. Documents may be withheld if they threaten to expose national security and for other privacy reasons, but ultimately the scope of disclosure would be subject to a judge's ruling if the requester sues. According to Justice Department's proposal, if the government believes records should be withheld, the government agency to which the request was made, quote, will respond to the request as if the excluded records did not exist, unquote. So all you teenagers or ex-teenagers who grew up saying, as if, look where this got you. Judges aren't very tough on the government when it comes to lying in Freedom of Information Act cases as it is. 2 weeks ago, just catching up with this, didn't know about this, a federal judge decided not to hold the CIA in contempt. Remember when they destroyed videotapes of enhanced interrogation sessions, despite rules and a judge's order not to do so? Okay, well, 2 weeks ago, that case concluded when a federal judge decided not to hold the CIA in contempt for destroying those videotapes of interrogations that included waterboarding, seen as torture by other civilized countries, including us, a long time ago, ruling instead that the spy agency merely committed, quote, transgressions for its failure to abide by his own court order in a Freedom of Information Act case brought by the ACLU. Punishing the CIA, according to U.S. District Judge Alvin Hellerstein of New York, quote, would serve no beneficial purpose, unquote, because CIA officials responsible for producing the tapes might, quote, not have been aware of the tapes' existence before they were destroyed, unquote. He went subjunctive on us, babe. Judge went subjunctive on our ass. And now, news of epic. First of all, where does polio still exist, ladies and gentlemen? You know, like you, I'd thought for years we'd wiped out polio because you don't meet anybody with polio anymore. Well, I have a friend who had polio as a child, but I mean, you know what I'm saying? But apparently we haven't wiped out polio anymore. Four countries in the world still have polio. Nigeria, they're too busy with emails to bother with the polio thing. The other three countries, India, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. Just saying. Spent a lot of money in that part of the world. They still got polio. See what I'm saying? Al-Qaeda's senior leadership has been devastated and its ability to operate is greatly diminished, according to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. That's what she told Congress. She said partnership with Pakistan was key to the success. But, she said, Pakistan should eliminate those safe havens for terror groups around across the border with Afghanistan. But, you know, we're doing great with Pakistan. Counterpoint to that, these excerpts from a documentary aired this week by BBC Television, quoting intelligence officials of the United States. They're the ones with American accents, and Great Britain. He's the one with a British accent.
In December of 2001, as American forces, American air power, and the Northern Alliance on the ground was putting the Taliban to the knife across the country, one of the more difficult episodes that really made it very, very difficult to trust the Pakistanis was the Kunduz airlift. And the Northern Alliance came to me in a fit of rage, stating that the Pakistani aircraft were landing in Kunduz on an airfield and were evacuating the Taliban. Those planes did fly in, and an air corridor allowed many of the leadership of the Taliban's Northern Command to be flown out of Afghanistan while the rest of us were trying to destroy them. I was horrified.
I was there on the ground, and the Americans said, well, you must be with us. We just lost 3,000 people. Well, not everybody was. And we shouldn't be surprised to find not only that there are people in Pakistan who before 9-1-1 were supporting the Taliban. Of course there were. They were trying to create a friend on their back door. And I remember watching things like the Kunduz operation saying we shouldn't be surprised that there were sympathizers within the Pakistani security service.
General Musharraf played the Bush administration like a fiddle. They gave us just enough in terms of Al-Qaeda to keep the Bush administration happy, but not enough to actually eliminate Al-Qaeda as an organization, and virtually nothing on the Taliban. Musharraf knew that before every major meeting between the two of them, he needed to reinforce his stock, and he did that by giving us a prominent Al-Qaeda operative. The Pakistanis would fortuitously, on the verge of a summit meeting between Bush and Musharraf, produce number four in the Al-Qaeda hierarchy. And that way, take away any criticism that might come from the Americans over Pakistan's double game.
We found out that 24 hours before going in, the HVT, in this case Dr. Zarawahiri, was given fair warning that you're about to be attacked, you better skedaddle. And the reason being is because the ISI was able to give tip-off information to the Al-Qaeda and Taliban folks in the safe haven and allow them to escape ahead of the attack.
Without the support that Pakistan gives, without providing a safe haven and also physical support and in some cases direction, I don't think the Taliban could have operated and could have built themselves up in the way they did.
By 2006, it was abundantly clear that the Pakistani intelligence service was orchestrating the revival of the Afghan Taliban. And to me, that was the moment when it was clear we'd been double dealt.
Well, you should have been listening to this show, sir. Been talking about our friend Pakistan since 2003. As longtime listeners to this broadcast know, the ISI is, of course, the Pakistani intelligence agency, located inside the army, but not necessarily subject to the army's orders. Much like the Corps of Engineers. Speaking of the Pakistani army, the army strongly denies that BBC documentary that Pakistani security services are supporting the Taliban in Afghanistan. The Pakistani army spokesman, Major General Athar Abbas described the allegations made by U.S. and Afghan officials and British officials, as you heard, as, quote, baseless and malicious. He claimed that the U.S. and Afghanistan are trying to blame Pakistan for their own failures. He pointed out, as they do, that the Pakistani Secret Service had itself suffered at the hands of Al-Qaeda and its affiliates, pointing to about 300 casualties. You think it is sane for an intelligence operator to harbor people who will attack its own men, he said. And he described the situation in Afghanistan. Thusly, the performance of all intelligence agencies in Afghanistan has been miserable. That's why they want to dump this on Pakistan and the ISI. And as if that's not enough, he added, we have the right to take legal action against the BBC. So Pakistan suing the BBC? Come on! Trials should be on TV, shouldn't they? And now, news of the warm, won't you?
Soft, listen to the warm. We can listen to the warm.
Yes, we can. A study quantifying each nation's contribution to global carbon emissions based on its role in the supply chain of energy production, from resource mining to burning of fuels, suggests that pricing carbon at the point of extraction, mining or burning, would simplify global efforts to curb emissions. In analysis of global data, this from the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, enacting carbon pricing mechanisms at the point of extraction would prevent the relocation of industries, which would likely occur if regulations were put in place at the point of combustion. Can't move the mines. Or can we? This becomes more relevant when you take into account that global temperatures rise could exceed safe levels of 2 degrees Celsius in some parts of the world in many of our lifetimes if greenhouse gas emissions continue to increase. Two research papers published in the journal Nature now warn. Certain levels of climate change are very likely within the lifetime of many people living now, unless emissions of greenhouse gases are substantially reduced in the coming decades, as a study by academics at the English universities of Reading and Oxford, the UK's Meteorological Office, Headley Centre, and the Victoria University of Wellington, New Zealand. Large parts of Eurasia, North Africa, and Canada could potentially experience individual five-year average temperatures that exceed the 2 degrees Celsius threshold by 2030, a timescale that's not so distant, according to the paper. 2 years ago, industrialized nations set that 2 degrees Celsius warming as the maximum limit to avoid dangerous climate changes, including more floods, droughts, and rising seas. Some experts said a 1.5 degree limit would be safer. Good luck to them. It's widely agreed among scientists that global pledges so far for curbing greenhouse gas emissions are not strong enough to prevent the dangerous change that would happen at the above the 2 degree level. This is backed up by another paper. The international community will not meet agreed temperature targets unless it puts the brakes on current levels of carbon emissions now. That's the warning from climate scientists led by Dr. Yuri Rogerij from the Institute of Atmospheric and Climate Science in Zurich. He analyzed emission scenarios to identify the likelihood of limiting global temperature rises to 2 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels. That analysis shows global median CO2 equivalent emissions need to peak and fall to 44 gigatons by 2020 to have a likely chance of meeting the targets set in Cancun. So, ladies and gentlemen, please watch your gigatons at home, won't you? Maybe have a gigaton monitor in the kitchen where the kids can check it. Sharp increases in temperature driven by global warming are melting China's Himalayan glaciers, an impact that threatens habitats, tourism, and economic development, says a study released this week of 111 weather stations scattered across southwestern China. 77% showed significant upticks in temperatures between 1961 and 2008, according to the study published in Environmental Research Letters. Yes, it's peer-reviewed. All the peers review it. At the 14 monitoring stations above 13,000 feet, the jump over this period was almost 2 degrees Celsius, roughly twice the average global increase over the last century. Researchers identified three changes occurring in glaciers that could be caused at least in part by the steady warming trend. Many of the glaciers examined showed a drastic retreat, as well as a large loss of mass, they reported. The study also showed that glacial lakes fed by runoff from resulting ice masses had expanded in size. The implications of these changes are far more serious than simply altering the landscape, the researchers warn. Glaciers are an integral part of thousands of ecosystems and play a crucial role in sustaining human populations. Southwestern China has 23,000 glaciers. Changes in rain and snowfall was less. You said changes was less. Who is this? Reuters? No. Space Daily. Well, they're not Grammar Daily, are they? Changes in snow and rain and snowfall were less marked, but still consistent with predictions by climate change models, the study found. News of the warm, ladies and gentlemen, grammatical or not, it's a copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
When the memories fill you, when the darkness finds you, may I please remind you that the heart takes time. Days will pass unbroken. The sun will shine, your heart might start to open. Sound a name, you break again, 'cause the heart takes time. Who can believe those tears that come unseen like waves in the night when we least expect them? Now you stand before me, dreaming of what might have been. Well, hindsight is a cruel friend, the bitterest pill. Now who can believe those tears that come unseen like waves in the night when we least expect them, when the memories fill you, when the darkness falls. Please remind you that the heart takes time. May I please remind you that the heart.
This is Le Show, backtracking the week's headlines, which is a copyrighted way of saying, let's go look at some older stuff. And at least a couple of listeners sent me links to this piece from a newspaper somewhere in the Arab world called Ahram Online. An Egyptian man was severely beaten after an Iraqi gang tried to kidnap and force him to film pornographic videos because of his astonishing resemblance to former Iraqi strongman Saddam Hussein. Mohammed Bishr says he was on his way to a cafe in Egypt's second city of Alexandria when three men wearing black suits tried to force him into the back of a van. The men had guns hanging from their belts. They forced me out of my car and shoved me into a van, says Bishr, a devout Muslim. He said the last thing he remembers was the men yelling at each other and then throwing him out of the van onto the pavement. His son says his father had previously met with a group of unidentified people who spoke Arabic in an Iraqi or Syrian dialect and had been offered a couple of million pounds Lebanese. Oh, so I guess this is a Lebanese newspaper because they talk about Lebanese pounds to impersonate the late dictator in a pornographic video. Bishr refused. After the meeting, his father received several telephone calls threatening him with kidnapping if he didn't change his mind and shoot the Saddam sex tape. It's believed his kidnappers would have tried to pass off the video recording they made as genuine and sell it to international media. Bishr has changed his residence four times to avoid such harassment. And as we know, Saddam had many lookalikes throughout his life to make public appearances or otherwise appear where it was advisable or convenient for him not to, one of whom we tracked down in the wake of this story, an occasional caller to this show. I think this is the first time we've called him, so it took our crack research staff time to, A, wake up, and B, figure out how to operate the computer with the new software and find the address book. But we have Shab, our old friend from Iraq, the Saddam lookalike, on the line right now to find out what, if any, light he can shed on this particular story. Shab, welcome back.
Good to be anywhere in these days. You know what I'm talking about.
Well,
and if you don't, good luck to you.
Well, thank you so much. The things are good.
Good.
Shab, mm-hmm. First of all, how are you? Where are you? Yeah. And what are you up to these days?
Mr. Sharir, I'm in Kirkuk in Iraq, the beloved city of Kirkuk.
Of course.
Attending the Iraqi Audio Society annual show.
Oh.
It's a big show for the dealers and the manufacturers of high-end audio gear.
Wow.
And every year we flock here to see the same goods that they sold last year. I know in your country they update them or somehow bring out new products and so forth and
sure.
so on.
Yeah.
Here we just put them back in the same boxes, put up the same booths, and we gather, have strong coffee, and enjoy each other's company one more time.
Well, nothing's wrong with strong coffee. So I guess you're still in the audio business?
I'm in an offshoot, Mr. Shearer. High-end audio hit the toilet, the crapper, as you might say, and it's not coming back. The number of people in Iraq who want to spend 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 dinars to buy a pair of high-end speakers to play MP Bleedy 3s. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
It's ridiculous. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
There are four of those people, and three of them are in my family. So, I'm in the public address system business. Democracy has been very good for that business.
Ah.
Everybody wants loudspeakers
sure.
to put on their cars and go through the streets to say no, or some variant of that. Or in the case of the Maliki government, yes.
Yes.
So I'm very active in that, trapping speakers onto the tops of automobiles, and of course they get shot at.
Yes.
And so the big business is replacement.
Wow. Well, so I guess congratulations for having made it to this this advanced stage of the recovery.
Thank you.
But the reason we're calling, or I'm calling Shab, is because of this story about an Egyptian gentleman who resembled, or does resemble Saddam Hussein, who claims he was kidnapped, at least momentarily, by people who were trying to force him to be in a pornographic film supposedly involving Saddam Hussein. I just wondered
talking about Bishr.
Hmm?
I know him well.
Oh.
I gave them his phone number and said, look, you use him next time.
Next time?
Yes.
So that implies that you worked with these people?
I don't care what it implies. I worked with these people.
Oh, okay.
Yes, sir, Mr. Shirir.
All right.
I'm not happy to tell you the story, but it's on your dime or your nickel or your whatever, your shekel, if I may.
Well.
So, yes, I worked with these people.
Mm.
It's not a pretty story, but it's a story.
Okay. Well, whatever you feel comfortable telling us, when was this and what exactly?
All right. It was 2009.
Mm-hmm.
Not a good year in Iraq.
Well.
Not a good year for me personally.
No, I'm sorry.
I'd had a shipment of BHK speakers.
Mm.
With the 15-inch woofer,
sure.
and they try axial crossover.
Oh yeah,
hijacked
oh.
off a van that I had paid for.
No,
I had people waiting. You know, in those days,
sure.
people were still waiting for this kind of equipment.
Mm-hmm.
I was in the the blue,
mm.
and people came to me and they said, Shab, we know you look like Saddam Hussein because you look like Saddam Hussein. You're not hiding it.
No.
Under a bushel or whatever. And
yeah.
I said, yes, I know. I shaved the mustache for a while, but I felt naked.
Huh.
And they said, well, now you're talking, sir.
Ooh.
And what I was persuaded to do, Mr. Shirir,
yes.
With the aid of I'll admit it, some funds changed hands.
Funds changed hands,
if you
yes.
know.
Yes.
This was supposed to be an educational film
oh.
for people to understand more about how to take care of. This was the humanitarian, humane society. They
ah,
said.
Ah.
Their reference to nakedness was the animals, of
ah,
course.
Of course.
And they said, we're trying to teach the Iraqis in the post-war period how to take better care of the animals that are their friends,
mm.
that in very cases may be their livelihoods.
Sure.
A very convincing story, Mr. Shirir.
I'm sure.
And in my particular case,
mm-hmm.
My assignment was to demonstrate the proper way, the proper and the humane way to take care of a donkey.
A donkey?
Yes, sir. And without going, because I know my ex-wife may be listening to your show.
Whoa.
Yes.
Your ex-wife?
Yes, sir.
Well, in all, pardon me, Shab, but in all the time we've conversed with you, I've never knew you were married or for that matter, divorced.
Mr. Shirir,
mm-hmm.
this is Iraq. This is not Oprah country. We do not spill our privacy matters all over your airwaves.
Well,
we get dubbed reruns of the Maury show on daytime, but that's about as bad as it gets.
That's pretty bad,
yes,
Maury. All right, so anyway, without giving your ex-wife any reason to do anything, what exactly happened with the dog?
Well, Mr. Shirir, let me just put it this way. I'm not an expert on animal husbandry
okay.
or care or humane treatment, but this was no way to treat a donkey. I don't think Saddam, in his worst mood, would have done this to a donkey. Uday or Hussein, maybe, but not the old man.
Wow. Okay. You've painted kind of a vague and yet very, very clear picture of and then when it was over, did they just thank you or make arrangements to see you again? Or?
They provided a cold shower.
Ooh.
And then said, we'll be in touch.
Mm-hmm.
If you like this, there's more. And that's when I gave them Bishar's number.
Yeah.
And now I feel bad about that.
Well,
but Mr. Shirir,
yes.
this is nothing. I have a friend who just did a video. He looks unbelievably like Muammar Gaddafi.
Ah.
And his video has been all over the internet. Supposedly what they did to Gaddafi before they killed him.
Yes.
And my friend, I'm not going to use his name.
No.
He's in enough trouble. It was a week and a half before he could sit down.
Wow. Well, I guess buy him a cushion or give him my best or something like that. Shab, remarkable story from a remarkable part of the world. What's your reaction to the impending, you know, the announcement
yes, sir.
A few days ago
yes,
by
sir.
President
Obama
yes. that all American troops are getting out. There will be no residual force of American forces after the end of this year.
Yes, sir. Well, as we all know, this is a ruse. There will be private contractors.
Oh, right.
They will be supporting the embassy, which is the largest in the world.
Yes.
That, to me, is the future.
Really?
Iraq will be a tourist attraction to rival Orlando, Florida. There you have, or Tokyo, you have maybe the largest theme park in the world.
Uh-huh.
But we have the largest embassy in the world. In the meantime, though, you know, I fear a little bit for the security of the Sunnis, the Shiites, the Kurds, all of us.
Yes.
But mainly, Mr.
Yes.
Shirir, fear.
Yes.
I fear for the donkeys.
All right. Sobering words from our old friend Chop Chop. Chop Chop, thank you very much for joining us on our Newsmaker line today, and best of luck.
If you need loudspeakers on top of your car, you call me, yes?
Yes, I certainly will. Good. And you get a hot shower, won't you?
Oh, I will.
Bye-bye. Chop Chop, ladies and gentlemen, joining us today. Backtracking the news here on the show.
Night lights, those blues in the night lights are no longer bright lights since I'm without you. Sweet dreams, oh, where did they fly to? You're gone, and whom can I cry to? Those night lights remind me of bright eyes and beautiful white lies, too good to be true. As I go on my way, with all my heart I pray that those night lights will lead me to you. Night lights remind me of bright eyes and beautiful white lies, too good to be true. As I go on my way, with all my heart I pray that those night lights will lead me to you.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of our friend the Atom. Our friend the Atom on this side of the Atlantic.
Love it over here. The French are such cool people.
They are, indeed.
Love Jerry Lewis and me.
They do. The disaster at the Fuk nuclear plant in March released far more radiation than the Japanese government has claimed, so concludes a study that combines radioactivity data from across the globe to estimate the scale and fate of emissions from the shattered plant. The study suggests that, contrary to government claims, ponds used to store spent nuclear fuel played a significant part in the release of the long-lived environmental contaminant cesium-137, which could have been prevented by prompt action. Who does that? The analysis has been posted at the journal Atmospheric Chemistry and Physics, in case you want to weigh in. The new study, on the basis of its reconstructions, claims that roughly twice the official government figure of cesium, half the release from Chernobyl. The higher number is obviously worrying, says one of the researchers, although ongoing ground surveys are the only way to truly establish the public health risk. One of the researchers believes the discrepancy between the team's results and those of the Japanese government can be partly explained by the larger data set used. He's sympathetic to the Japanese teams responsible for the official estimate. That makes one of us. Radiation levels as high as those in the evacuation zone around Fuk have been detected in a Tokyo suburb. The radiation hotspot was found in a vacant lot. Hey, place for your new mall in Kashiwa, a commuter suburb on the outskirts of Japan's capital. Radiation levels of 2 microsieverts per hour were detected 1 meter above the surface of the soil. That would be right where you'd put the food court, I think. Equivalent to some areas in the evacuation zone around the crippled Fuk plant. City officials have also found contamination levels as high as 57.5 microsieverts per hour in the soil, sparking radiation fears in the neighborhood. It's about 195 kilometers from the accident site. You figure out the miles. Japan will likely need more than 30 years to dismantle the crippled Fuk plant, according to the Atomic Energy Commission this week, underscoring the prolonged challenges. But it's cheap and it's safe. A subcommittee called for the removal of melted nuclear fuel rods to start within 10 years. At Three Mile Island, fuel removal started 6.5 years after the meltdown accident, but it will likely take longer at Fuk since it suffered a more severe accident. Or, in Reuters' words, a severer accident. Hello, Reuters. Hello. The subcommittee estimated it would take more than 3 decades to complete the process of taking out melted fuel rods from damaged reactors and dismantling the plant. The report did not provide estimated costs for the whole dismantling process. Well, that's why it's cheap. We don't count. China, nearby, is facing increasing safety risks from its nuclear power plants as existing facilities age. Really? That's not supposed to happen, is it? Was that in the plan? And a large number of new reactors go into operation, this according to the country's environmental minister. The safety standards of China's early phase nuclear facilities are relatively low. Operation times are long, some facilities are obsolete, and the safety risks are increasing, says Zhu Zhengzhan. Aside from that, Mrs. Rinken, the plants are fine. The Japanese government's Nuclear and Industrial Safety Agency released part of an unedited severe accident manual for the Fuk No. 1 plant. It shows that TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Company, which ran the plant, had not envisioned the possibility of all power sources at the nuclear complex being lost. That's right. The electric company didn't envision complete loss of electricity.
That could happen to anybody.
Good point. Clean, cheap, safe, too. Clean, haven. Our friend the atom. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week. The mayor of Oakland, California, Gene Kwan, has apologized for the clashes between police and demonstrators that left one demonstrator badly injured. Kwan, who has been roundly criticized for her handling of the Occupy protests against economic inequality, said she had met that protester, Scott Olson, and his parents, and she was concerned about his recovery. He remains in fair condition. "I'm deeply saddened about the outcome on Tuesday," Kwan said in a video statement posted online. "It was not what anyone hoped for. Ultimately, it was my responsibility, and I apologize for what happened. We can change America, but we must unite and not divide our city. I hope we can work together." She went all Wilbert Harrison on us. ESPN has apologized for what it called an inappropriate comment made on ESPN News following Texas Tech's college football win over Oklahoma Sooners. Oh, you get so tired of that. ESPN anchor Todd Grisham, in conjunction with a shot of distraught Oklahoma fans, referred to the Trail of Tears. Historically, that phrase is known to refer to Native American Cherokees being forcibly removed from their lands in Georgia and sent on a forced march to Oklahoma that led to many deaths. But hey, that's American exceptionalism. On Twitter, meanwhile, Grisham, the ESPN anchor, said the historical reference didn't even cross my mind, and added that his great-grandmother was a full-blooded Cherokee. So get off his back. No, he didn't say that. I ventriloquized that for him. Hey, I verbed it. Minnesota Vikings defensive end Brian Robeson issued an apology on Twitter to Packers offensive lineman T.J. Lang after Robeson kicked Lang in the groin during a game last week. That's gotta hurt, even for football players. Boy, he got his other bell rung, didn't he? My apologies to my team, my fans, and the NFL, Robeson tweeted. I am not a dirty player and did not maliciously aim for the groin. Just happened to be where it landed. The groin is a well-known boot magnet. Other sports apologies. Devin LaRussa, the daughter of St. Louis Cardinals manager Tony LaRussa, apologized and removed an offensive tweet. Stop tweeting, you people in sports. You're no good at it. The tweet she sent last Sunday night regarding Texas Ranger manager Ron Washington. Her tweet, I saw a crackhead doing the wash today. Coincidence? I think not. The wash is a reference to Washington's furious leg pumping in the dugout during critical plays and games. Washington did test positive for cocaine during the 2009 season. LaRussa later removed the tweet and posted this one. I really, truly did not mean to be offensive. It's a phrase I use meant as a joke. Please don't be offended. And every one of those sentences ended with an exclamation point. So she really, really, totally, like, means it. A British journalist for the newspaper The Guardian has apologized after being accused of anti-Semitism following an article in which she maintained that Israel's eagerness to bring home Gilad Shalit, the soldier who was repatriated in exchange for 1,000 Palestinian prisoners, was based on a, quote, Zionist belief that the lives of the chosen are of hugely greater consequence than those of their unfortunate neighbors. This stirred an uproar, as you might imagine. She said she was sorry for the words she used. First, I'm certainly not anti-Semitic, she told the Jerusalem Post, and I don't want to sound as if I am, so I'm sorry if the form of words I used gave that impression. Often, however, she added, it seems difficult to be critical of the Israeli state without such accusations being made. So she dug deeper. Complaining that the reaction to a recent tweet of his was out of hand, actor Orlando Jones has reversed an earlier decision to offer no apologies, tweeting that liberals should, quote, kill Sarah Palin, unquote, wasn't as funny as Jones thought it would be. So the comedian, actor, former 7-Up pitchman, why didn't they offer that choice at Career Day? Has apologized for offering up the offensive advice. This has gotten way out of hand, he wrote on his Facebook page, referring to his tweet that stated, Libyan rebels kill Gaddafi. If American liberals want respect, they better stop listening to Aretha and kill Sarah Palin. On his Facebook page, the apology read, I pray that no harm comes to Governor Palin. I'm not a political pundit. Oh! And I certainly don't believe in murder. I think laughter is great medicine. I'd love to elevate the conversation, but no one seems interested in that. So I'll keep on going for the smiles, even when I miss by a mile. Unquote. The apology is a reversal since he first said when pressed about his tweet on Tuesday, my job as an artist is to hold up a mirror to society. I do not decide how people feel or react to that. I offer no apologies. Mirror's cracked, babe. University of Pennsylvania orthopedic surgeon John D. Kelly, the fourth, says the monthly humor column he writes for a medical trade magazine was due, so he threw some jokes together about fat patients. You should worry about performing surgery on the supersized, he riffed, if there is a comma in your patient's body weight, or if the patient wears the wristwatch on his finger, or has more chins than a Chinese phone book, and many more. So Kelly has been chewed out by obesity bias fighters, as well as subscribers of Outpatient Surgery magazine, where the article appeared, and his bosses at the hospital or medical center, who's issued a statement saying his comments do not in any way reflect the health system's views. In response, Kelly has expressed what even critics call heartfelt response. He does moonlight as a stand-up comic at such venues as the Casbah Comedy Club in Wildwood, New Jersey. Eight shows nightly. Kelly did not respond to requests for comment from the Philadelphia Inquirer. But his twin brother, Michael, a lawyer, said, I know of no doctor who's more passionate and concerned about his patients. All of them. And I mean all of them. No, he didn't say that. He has received high patient satisfaction ratings, says Dr. Kelly at Penn. And he's received several Teacher of the Year awards, but no Comedian of the Year awards. Unusually enough. All right, babe, I'm not going to practice medicine. You figure out the rest. An Edmonton, Canada woman has filed a human rights complaint after her autistic 9-year-old daughter and service dog were told to leave a mall called Winners for the second time in 3 months. It's a discount clothing store in a mall, ordered Ainsworth's daughter Emily and her dog Levi to leave the premises last July, but later apologized to the family. The store sent Emily a formal apology, a card featuring a puppy on the cover and a $25 gift card. The apology was written by Edmonton District Manager for TJX Canada, the parent company of Winners. I followed up with the store and the manager involved, and he was very apologetic, said Mike Faulkner, the district manager for TJX. He certainly didn't mean any offense at all and was upset to hear that you and your daughter were upset. My biggest concern is that your daughter doesn't feel welcome. So if you don't mind spoiling her a bit, I'd like to give her a $25 gift card. Last week, Emily, Levi, and her mother visited the store to use the gift card when they were told by store staff that Levi, whose harness identifies him as a service dog, was not allowed into the store. We were asked to leave the store again, she said. Emily said leaving the store made her sad. No comment from Levi. Deadline Newark, a baggage screener who left a note saying, "Get your freak on, girl," inside a woman's suitcase that contained a sex toy, will be fired, according to the TSA. Quote, TSA views the handwritten note to be highly inappropriate and unprofessional and apologizes for this unfortunate incident, says spokesman Kawika Riley in an emailed statement. The apologies of the week, getting its freak on every week as a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archive, whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, available for your smartphone at Stitcher.com, and available as a free podcast at KCRW.com. And be just like not apologizing for your tweets on your Facebook account, if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Already, thank you very, very much. Tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead, and thanks to Adrian Bodnum at Global Radio here in London for helping to make today's show possible. More than possible, actually exist. This broadcast is on Twitter at The Harry Shearer. Almost 48,000 followers and no apologies on Facebook. Think of it. And if you're in New Zealand, The Big Uneasy screens on Sky Arts November 18th. Save the date. Hell, save the plum. Save all the fruit. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. So long from London.